Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have Professor Zachary Lachman, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern Studies at New York University. We're going to be talking about his 2004 book, Contending Visions of the Middle East, The History and Politics of Orientalism. We're going to try to dig deeper into this question, whether there is, in fact, this clash of civilizations that some say, where they say that the Muslim world has inherent differences to the Western world. So please stick around. Professor Lachman.
Hi. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, great. We left off where we're talking about how there's some notions about Islam and about Muslims, and that may have been even reinforced since 9/11, where Islam still seems very alien, very other, very strange. Could you continue that a little bit, what you were saying?
Sure. So until the last couple of decades, there were not a great many Muslims in the United States. And I think for a lot of people, both Christians and Jews in the United States, Islam was very unknown, and for many maybe even alien or actually threatening. There was a sense of this whole other world out there about which Americans knew very little, and what they knew or thought they knew was often inaccurate or based on, you know, some very strange notions, some of which have very long historical roots, going back to Europe in the Middle Ages and even to the early encounters between Christianity and Islam 1,000, 1,200 years ago. Obviously, there's been a large immigration from predominantly Muslim lands. There's a growing number of Muslim Americans who will increasingly be part of the fabric of American life in the decades to come. But because of the complicated involvement of the United States in many parts of the Muslim world, the Middle East, but also elsewhere, and of course because of September 11th and because of other kinds of incidents and the invasion of Iraq and on, a great many Americans, you know, have a sense of Muslims as not like us, as fundamentally different, as fanatical, and as have very little real understanding of Islam and its complexity and diversity, and tend to see Muslims very differently as they see other people, even people from other kinds of cultural backgrounds, other countries.
This is really one of the big themes of your book, how there's this tendency to see Muslims as a distinct civilization. And you mentioned, and others mentioned, how this is really not accurate, an ahistorical and very much reductionist perspective. Can you talk about how Western and Eastern societies have molded and defined each other throughout history?
Sure. People in this country and in Western Europe and elsewhere tend to see themselves as part of something called the West. Now, this is, in historical terms, a notion that goes back, you know, maybe 500 years or can be traced back that far. And in the 19th century, the notion was very widespread in Western Europe and in the United States. That you can divide up the world, the peoples of the world, into distinct civilizations. And this whole notion recently got a boost in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union with Samuel Huntington and his book, The Clash of Civilizations. But it has older roots. He argued that you can divide up all of humanity into 7-8 distinct civilizations, each of which has their different culture, each of which is radically different from one another, their own ways of doing things, their own religious notions, and so on. To my mind, this is not a very useful notion. Just take Islam, right? There are a billion and a quarter Muslims in the world, and they live in places that range from Indonesia to Iran to Turkey to Egypt to Morocco to Germany to Britain to Detroit. And there's incredible diversity. If you actually start looking, it's really hard to lump all these people together in any useful ways. We would not think of all Christians being the same. Even if we looked at the United States and looked at Christianity or looked at politically active Christians, we would see Jesse Jackson on the left and Pat Robertson on the right and all sorts of people at different points along the spectrum in between those two. And there, you know, one could come up with many other polls. We wouldn't say that all Christians do this. If we wanted to explain why Pat Robertson believes what he believes, we wouldn't probably go to the Gospels, because we know that Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and Jim Wallace on the Christian left, on the Protestant left, read those same Gospels but come up with a very different interpretation in terms of what a Christian should do. we would want to look at what is it about the United States over the last couple of years that led to the emergence of a Protestant evangelical right, as well as many other interpretations and movements that base themselves in Christianity. So we can apply that same principle to Islam, and we see a wide diversity of interpretations. We see very lively, very vigorous conversations in print, but now, of course, through the web as well, among Muslims about what Islam is, about how to interpret tradition, about what aspects of their faith must be adhered to, what others can be modified in light of changing circumstances, and so on. The same applies to Jews, to Hindus, to everyone. That's, I think, a better way to think about how the world works. Unfortunately, in the United States, partly because there are these old legacies of seeing Islam and Muslims as threatening, as fanatical, as irrational, and a deep lack of understanding of Islam and the Muslim world, people tend to treat Islam as if it's a monolithic thing, as if it's one thing, unchanging, the same as it's always been. And that leads us into problems. It gets us into interpretations and ways of acting in the world that end up being really counterproductive.
Along this line, you mentioned how we really can't talk about Islam and the Western relations in the 20th century to now without talking about some of the colonialistic tendencies of the West. For example, Britain and France redrawing the map after World War I, the United States in Iran in 1953. Can you talk about how this history has really affected the modern-day Islamic world view of the West?
Sure, and here we get into a lot of very complicated, entangled issues. There has been an interpretation out, which has been put out by people like Bernard Lewis, who's now very elderly, but has been for 50 years, really, a well-known scholar of Islam, and very much the sort of house intellectual of the neoconservatives. He was invited to the Bush White House right after September 11th, and in many articles and books and speeches and op-ed pieces has put out his view. That view argues, basically, that Islam is a sort of wounded civilization. It's a failed civilization. It failed to engage with modernity. And the fact that we have people like bin Laden and these kinds of extremist Muslim organizations and movements and tendencies is a symptom of the rage and anger that Muslims feel about their failure to successfully deal with the modern world. So you've got this kind of view out there. There are others as well, but this kind of view has had some prominence over the last couple of years. You know, to my mind, it misses a lot of what's really going on, right? We know there are lots of Muslims in many parts of the world who live thoroughly modern lives. In this sense, it makes no sense to see Muslims as being any different, basically, in how they engage in the world than Jews and Christians. So there are fundamentalist Christians, we know, in the United States. In Israel, there are fundamentalist, fanatical, religious, nationalist settlers in the West Bank, right, who believe that God has told them to keep and settle the West Bank and are very hostile to any Palestinian aspirations. We can look at Hindu nationalists in India who tend to be very anti-Muslim. But of course, there are many other people in India who are also Hindus or profess Hinduism, but have very different beliefs and live very modern secular lives. And all these movements themselves are modern products. They don't go back hundreds of years. They come out of modern situations, and they're one of many responses to things that have gone on over recent years. In the case of Islam and the Middle East, of course, colonialism is an important piece of this. These are lands which, for varying periods, were dominated by colonial powers, by Britain and France, first and foremost, which ruled over them, which shaped them as modern societies, which helped to set the stage for some of the problems these countries face today. And of course, since the Second World War, the United States has been the dominant power, certainly in the Middle East, but also in many other predominantly Muslim lands as well. So there is certainly resentment and anger towards the United States, but I don't think among many Muslims, but I don't think it has a great deal to do with any ingrained Islamic resentment of foreigners, right? Many of the same people who don't like the policies of the Bush administration in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt or in Iran would love to send their children to come and study in the United States. And some of them would love to come immigrate to the United States and benefit from democracy and from opportunity, which they're denied in their own country. So there's nothing, it's not a cultural issue, it's a political issue. There's a great deal of anger and resentment at the policies that the United States has followed for quite a few decades of intervening in the Middle East, of overthrowing governments, in some cases of invading countries, as we saw most dramatically in Iraq, in ways that many people in the region and in the wider world resent. They see the United States as an overbearing bully, which is partly responsible, at least, for the kind of lives that they live. Of course, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as we're seeing these days, plays into this. Many people in the Arab world and in the Muslim world see the United States as the chief backer of Israel. And when they see what's going on in Gaza, for example, where a lot of the bombs and shells that are falling on the people of Gaza are made in the United States and supplied by the United States, they feel pretty angry. Again, this doesn't have anything to do with Islam. It doesn't have anything to do with any sort of cultural resentment. It has to do with concrete policies, which people see as a continuation of the old-fashioned kind of colonial intervention, which has deep roots in this part of the world.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and we're talking to Professor Zachary Lachman, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern Studies at New York University, about his 2004 book, Contending Visions of the Middle East, The History and Politics of Orientalism. We're trying to dig deeper into this question, whether there is this clash of civilizations, as some say that there is. So please stick around. Thank you.
This might cross over into the last question a little bit, but in your book, you talk about how challenges arise from movements which argue that their version of Islam is really the only authentic solution to very, very profound social and cultural and economic problems facing their societies. And then, you know, as you mentioned, there are certain scholars that claim that these challenges are basically inherent in Islam and can be traced back to its classical period. So can you, the Islamism that's in some areas today, can you put that in the historical framework that you think is proper and how we should address these challenges?
Sure. It might be helpful to use the analogy with the United States. We know that over the last couple of decades, there has emerged a significant political movement, which has played a very large role ultimately in the Republican Party. It constitutes a good chunk of the base of the Republican Party, which consists of people who see themselves as Protestant, predominantly Protestant Christians, and have rather right-wing views. So we can see this as a politicization of religion. And people who've looked at it have tried to explain why in a certain historical period in the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, down to the present, certain people from certain social backgrounds were attracted to this understanding of Christianity and this kind of politicized understanding of Christianity, which has had an impact on the American political system. We wouldn't, if we wanted to explain the rise of the evangelical right in the United States, again, go back to the Gospels, we wouldn't say there's something inherent in Christianity about this, because as we know, there are many other interpretations in American society of Christianity. The great majority of American Christians aren't part of the right-wing evangelical movement. So it isn't something inherent in Christianity, it's something that comes out of the social, political, economic, cultural developments of the last couple of decades, which have produced this movement as well as many other things. It's pretty much the same with Islam. So among Sunni Muslims, you had in the earlier part of the 20th century, the emergence of many kinds of political movements seeking change in their societies. You had secular nationalist movements, which were very influential in places like Egypt, down to President Nasser, right, who was quite secular and was trying to develop an Arab nationalism, which would encompass all Arabs, regardless of religion. Now, you also had movements which defined themselves in terms of religion, which developed a sort of very politicized understanding of Islam, and argued that the problems that their societies faced were not primarily foreign domination, they weren't economic inequality, it wasn't something socialism might be a solution to, that you needed a return to proper moral values, to the precepts of the faith as they interpreted them. But of course, they interpreted them selectively. They focused on some things rather than other things, as Christians do, as as the evangelical right does in the United States. They tend not to focus on social justice. They tend to go for a very conservative social policy. So the Islamist movements focused on certain things rather than others. There's nothing inherently Muslim about this, right? Because people in these countries, the great majority of them, profess Islam. But these parties get the support of some fraction of that society, but not everyone. So clearly what you have here are differing, often conflicting interpretations of Islam. And these people, even though they claim to speak for Islam, of course, are only speaking for one particular interpretation, which many fellow Muslims either reject or ignore. And we always have to make sense of these movements. There certainly are people who, you know, like Al-Qaeda, like bin Laden, who've come up with very, you know, extremist, radical interpretations of Islam and have advocated the use of terrorism, among other things, to achieve their goals, right? But it's also true that a great many Muslims, the great majority of Muslims, reject those kinds of means, also based on their understanding of their faith, which they believe does not justify violence. So it's really a diversity of views, as it is in any faith, and it's also very much a product of the modern world. So we always have to look, I think, at historical context. We always have to see how these kinds of movements, these ideas, surface and gain traction among some number of people because of contemporary circumstances. We can't assume that Islam, Christianity, Judaism, or anything else has been the same for 2,000 or 3,000 years, unchanging, and what we're seeing now is just a manifestation of that unchanging essence. Faith, societies, people are always changing, and as a result, you get these new things, the product of modern circumstances.
In Edward Said's 1995 reprinting of Orientalism, he writes that that he thinks that while animosities and inequities very still much exist, they're not the eternal order, but a historical experience whose end or partial abatement could be at hand. I know he wrote this before the first years of the 21st century, but are we able to use this statement to garner optimism, especially with all everything that's going on now, namely that the Israeli-Hamas conflict is not an eternal order, but some type of abatement could be at hand? I know you write that Palestinian resistance might only end when they see another way to realize nationalistic aspirations.
I think we have to be optimistic, and I think Edward Said, for all his criticism of what he saw as Western misrepresentations of the East, of Islam, of the Middle East, remained an optimist, remained very much a humanist, because things do change. I mean, think about it. There was a time a couple of hundred years ago in Western Europe when Catholics and Protestants slaughtered each other. And the idea that whether you were a Catholic or a Protestant would one day not mean a whole lot or would not lead you to kill somebody else or be killed seemed sort of utopian. And, of course, over time, things changed. And in Western Europe or in the United States or in many other places, it doesn't make all that much difference. There was a time when people said that Catholic countries could never really be democracies because they are always bound by this Catholic ideology or their subservience to the Pope. And even in the United States, the idea of a Catholic president, you know, took some accepting by a fair number of people. And it was an issue when John F. Kennedy was running for the presidency. Or to bring it even more up to date, the idea that there could be an African-American president seemed impossible to people given the very racist legacy of the United States and it's the persistence of racism in American society down to the present. And yet, in a couple of days, Barack Obama will be sworn in as president. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or the conflict over Palestine between Jews and Arabs, doesn't go back thousands of years. It goes back a century and a quarter, roughly, to the beginnings of Zionist settlement in Palestine. It's produced a lot of bloodshed. There's been a lot of violence. What's going on in Gaza now is obviously horrific. But it's also not impossible that these political issues, difficult as they are, could be resolved. And just as France and Germany are no longer mortal enemies ready to fight the next war, and the idea of such a war doesn't really occur to many people, many younger people, especially in Europe, One can envision, at least in theoretical terms, a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that could create the basis for a new kind of relationship. I think the same will happen in American society, actually, with Islam over time, right? Because there are now more Muslims in the United States than there are Episcopalians. I think there are about or close to being as many Muslims in the United States as there are Jews. Inevitably, the children of the immigrants and more who come in will be part of American society, as are Jewish Americans and Mexican Americans and so on. But they'll retain something distinctive, and they will gradually make a place for Islam in American society. And people will, you know, have to deal with neighbors who are Muslims. There will be tensions. There's certainly some degree of Islamophobia in American society. There'll be issues about this, but there'll be change as well. And just as the United States accommodated Catholics and accommodated Jews, it will, and accommodated Latinos, right, speakers of Spanish, and there are ongoing issues about this, it will have to deal with the fact that, you know, a significant part of its population are Muslims who have ties to their countries of origin, who have views about what's going on in the world that they'll want to put forward. And, you know, there's room for change here in ways that may in fact be hopeful.
As you mentioned in the book, there's a dire need for a better understanding among Americans of what is actually going on, and how it's really not productive at all to reduce it to they don't like our democracy and things like that. I wanted to just put in a part where we need a pitch for Americans really to understand what's going on.
Sure, I think that's absolutely critical, especially given that the United States is so deeply and painfully entangled in many parts of the Arab world and the wider Muslim world, right? The invasion of Iraq, obviously, but the United States is the dominant power in the Middle East. It props up the government of Saudi Arabia and of Egypt and of the, you know, the Gulf principalities that produce oil and so on. It's in hostile terms with Iran. The United States is the main ally of Israel in its, you know, wars with the Palestinians, on and on. One can go on to Indonesia, et cetera. I mean, many parts of the world, Central Asia, South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the United States is very deeply involved. And in addition, of course, to growing Muslim American communities in this country. So there's a desperate need, I think, for Americans to understand Islam as a faith in all its diversity and complexity, but also the people's histories, cultures of the places in which the United States plays a very important role, exerts a lot of power, often in very dangerous, counterproductive, even disastrous kinds of ways, as we've seen from the American intervention in lots of places around the world. This is essential knowledge for Americans. I'm not sure there was ever a time when Americans could afford to be ignorant about the rest of the world. Certainly, they cannot afford now, in the wake of September 11th and many other things, to be ignorant about the Middle East and about the wider Muslim world. Because increasingly, the boundaries between over there and over here are disappearing, right? September 11th was a consequence, in some sense, of America's involvement in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, and you know, various other things. So the consequences of American power exerted abroad increasingly come home and affect what happens right here, which means that Americans really need to understand where all this comes from. They need to understand the character and the history of U.S. involvement in the rest of the world and something about those societies there, because what happens there will affect us as well. And beyond that, Americans, I think, have a moral responsibility to know what their government is doing in their name, to understand and be able to judge and hopefully influence American foreign policy, which, at least to my mind, too often has led to disastrous consequences, first and foremost for the people on the receiving end of American power, but again, increasingly, as we saw on September 11th, for people here as well. And if we want a more sane, a more intelligent, a more just relationship between the United States and the rest of the world, Americans have to learn, they have to educate themselves, and they have to then use that knowledge by speaking out, by affecting what their government does in their name.
And I just wanted to wrap up with one more question. Well, with the current conflict that we're seeing in Gaza, how do we use what we learned from your book
to answer those from the right who say that there shouldn't be any accommodation for these radical, you know, quoting, I don't know, Daniel Pipes and others, that there shouldn't be any accommodation for Hamas, that there should just be aggressive behavior on the part of the Israelis. How would you respond to something like that?
Certainly, many people in this country have bought into the official Israeli line that Hamas is nothing but a terrorist movement, so that whatever Israel does, even if it ends up killing as many Palestinian civilians as it does Hamas militants, well, that's okay. So this is part, I think, of a wider misunderstanding, a not very useful way of thinking about these kinds of movements. I don't share Hamas's politics. They've done some nasty and certainly unjustifiable things. But if you want to deal with Hamas, if you want to weaken it, you have to understand where it comes from. It is a political movement with deep roots in Gaza and among Palestinians. It grew not because many of the people who voted for it in the 2006 elections love every aspect of its political program and of its vision for the future, but because they saw it as an uncorrupt, honest, effective alternative to what they saw as a bankrupt Palestinian leadership, the leadership of Yasser Arafat and his successor Mahmoud Abbas. So it did very well in those elections because people saw it as offering something different and perhaps better. Beyond that, there is complicated history here going back to when Hamas first emerged, and people tend not to remember that in the 1970s, the Israeli occupation authorities in Gaza actually not only tolerated but encouraged the movements, the organizations that eventually formed Hamas, because they saw them as a non-political, safe alternative to the Palestine Liberation Organization. Obviously, that wasn't a very clever policy, but there's complicated history here. And again, one has to understand that Hamas cannot be eradicated by force. There's no military solution to this. So using this kind of massive force under the illusion that you can destroy Hamas and deal with the symptom rather than the root causes, which is the ongoing occupation, which is what gives Hamas its energy, which is what gives it its popular support among Palestinians, is a dead end. And a dead end, of course, that costs the lives of hundreds of innocent people who are trapped in Gaza under Israeli siege. So in dealing with Hamas, you get the same kind of blind, hard-lined, historically ignorant kind of approach that we've got, you know, more generally. And it's the product of the same kind of policies, right? The United States and Afghanistan, to defeat the Soviets, encouraged some vast, very nasty elements, which once the Soviets were out of Afghanistan, decided to turn their guns on the United States. So in a sense, as some people have described it, this is Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and September 11th are a blowback, in a sense, for the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Well, you can also see, you know, Hamas and what's going on now as blowback for years of failed policies. Those who advocate this kind of thing are only contributing and only enabling the same cycle of failed policies and the use of force that Israel has engaged in for a very long time. So we clearly need another perspective. We need to engage with people, even if we don't love their political views, and we need to find some way to negotiate the solution to this problem rather than try to impose it by brute force.
Professor Lachman, thanks so much for this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was our interview with Professor Zachary Lachman, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern Studies at New York University, talking about the clash of civilizations, or at least that hypothesis. So thanks so much for listening. For past shows and listener comments, please visit logicconsortium.blogspot.com. You can also find us on iTunes. Have a great day.